Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. It's Thursday, June 27th. I'm Rebecca Kern, in for Stephen Overly. The Supreme Court is nearing the end of its term, and there are three major tech cases I've been closely tracking. And since you're listening to this podcast, you probably have been too. Those are Murthy v. Missouri, NetChoice v. Paxson, and Moody v. NetChoice, all of which have to do with social media companies and the First Amendment. On Wednesday morning, one of those opinions dropped, Murthy v. Missouri. In Murthy v. Missouri, the Supreme Court dismissed the claims that the Biden administration pressured platforms to censor speech. In a 6-3 decision, the justices ruled that two conservative states and five individuals didn't have legal standing to sue Biden White House officials over claims they coerced platforms to remove misinformation related to COVID-19 and the 2020 election outcomes. This has led to criticism from conservatives who are using it as a rallying cry to push for action in Congress. To break all this down, I called up Alex Abdo. Alex is the litigation director at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. The institute calls itself a defender of free speech in the digital age. And in fact, we talked to him for this podcast last fall, back when the Supreme Court announced they'd hear this case. So, on the show today, Alex unpacks the ruling and what he thinks is missing. Alex, welcome to Politico Tech.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, on Wednesday, we had a decision come out from the Supreme Court in Murthy v. Missouri, and it's a big case we've been watching about the Biden administration's perceived pressure on social media platforms and whether that amounted to censorship and violated the First Amendment. And so I wanted to get your impression on the biggest takeaway.
Well, I think the decision is largely a vindication for the administration. The court seemed unpersuaded that the pressure campaign that the plaintiffs were pointing to amounted to a vast scheme of censorship in the way that the plaintiffs had characterized the administration's efforts during the litigation. But I think it's a little bit unclear what the decision actually means for the administration going forward. You know, we are in the middle of an election year. Presumably, the platforms will be rife with misinformation as they were last election cycle, and presumably, federal agencies will want to weigh in one form or another. But the decision doesn't give the government all that much guidance on where the lines are between what is constitutionally okay, which is persuasion, and what is constitutionally not okay, which would be coercion. And so if I were, you know, working for the administration, I think I'd have a lot of questions remaining even after getting the victory that this decision is for the administration.
Right. And so we wanted to break down the ruling as well. It was over this issue of quote-unquote jawboning, wherein the government is allegedly pressuring removal of certain content. This was related to COVID-19 misinformation, some election misinformation, and the state said that it amounted to censorship. You know, was this the outcome you expected? Based on oral arguments, it did seem the justices were leaning this way.
Yeah, I think at argument, this is what, if the justices were telegraphing anything, this is what they are telegraphing. And, you know, the core of the claim being made by the plaintiffs is that the administration coerced the platforms into taking down alleged disinformation about the 2020 election and about, you know, the COVID-19 vaccines. And the questions that the justices were asking at the oral argument had to do with whether the plaintiffs could really connect conduct by the government with the decisions by the platforms to actually take down their posts on Facebook or LinkedIn or, you know, any of the platforms at issue. And the ruling on Wednesday held that they, as a general matter, couldn't draw a clear line between the pressure that the government was allegedly putting on the platforms with the decisions of the platforms to take down the speech. And that was for a couple of reasons. One is the court said that often the decision to take down some of the plaintiff's speech predated the alleged pressure by the government. So, you know, there was a lot of, you know, a number of decisions made in 2020 to take down speech, and yet the plaintiffs were pointing to government pressure that didn't come until 2022, for example. The court also thought that there were very good reasons to think that the platforms were acting independently in the service of their own interests, enforcing their own policies, and not acting at the behest of the government. And that's not surprising because the platforms, you know, do and did have policies against misinformation. And they adopted those policies for the most part independently because they're trying to create a community that will attract, you know, the most number of users, not to create cesspools of disinformation and hate, et cetera. So those are some of the problems that the justices had with the plaintiff's theory of the case. And at the end of the day, they held, you haven't shown that it is sufficiently likely that the explanation for the platform's decisions to take down your speech was government pressure. And instead, it seems more likely that it may have been the platform's independent editorial decisions, you know, made at different times. And so they said, you haven't justified the preliminary injunction that the Fifth Circuit, which was the appeals court in the case, had issued against the administration. And so it reversed.
And I wanted to just see, you know, what notable dissents you noticed. We had a joint dissent filed by Justices Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Clarence Thomas, some of the most conservatives on the court, who had all raised some concerns about censorship in the oral arguments. So anything notable there that you wanted to call out, and any kind of outrage outside of the court from conservatives who've felt like the ruling, you know, was, I guess, not in the direction they wanted to see it going?
Yeah, I mean, so the bulk of Justice Alito's dissent focuses on one of the plaintiffs, a woman named Jill Hines. And what's really interesting is that he presents the facts relating to her experience in a just entirely different way than the majority does. And so you have six justices who are very skeptical of this individual's claims of censorship and three who seem persuaded that she experienced censorship at the hands of the government. That's not surprising. That happens all the time in Supreme Court cases where justices look at the same set of facts and arrive at very different conclusions. What I found most notable, though, about the dissent was the introduction. Justice Alito starts by saying, before I'm going to get into the facts, there are two things I want to flag that are really important. And I agreed with both of these. He said, first, the platforms have become the predominant place that a lot of people get their news, especially given the decline of traditional media. And that is factually, I think, true that, you know, many people now get their news from social media. And so it's important, the rules that apply to social media are really important for that reason. And the second thing he said, which we also pointed out in the amicus brief that we filed, is that the platforms are vulnerable targets of, you know, government pressure campaigns because they are so centralized. And that's something that we highlighted in our amicus brief, too. We explained that the platforms are really attractive targets for government censorship because if you can convince just a handful of companies to adopt your preferred policies on the speech that is acceptable, then you will have accomplished quite a bit of censorship or quite a bit of distortion of public discourse because so many people use so few platforms. And that's a reason why the First Amendment rules that protect these platforms from government coercion are really important. And it's the reason why it would be nice to have more clarity on what those lines are. And so I'm sympathetic to that part of Justice Alito's dissent, you know, to his complaint that we need to have clearer rules for the road when it comes to these platforms because they are going to be unsurprising, you know, targets of, you know, the government, whether it's the federal government or the states or any of the hundreds of municipalities around the country. They are going to be targets for, you know, pressure campaigns. So it would be good to have clearer rules that protect them from coercion so that, you know, the speech of Americans is not left to the whims of political actors who are acting in their own best interests.
Right. I did see that was a part of a statement you put out on Wednesday as well. And I wanted to see what your thoughts are on House Judiciary Chair Jim Jordan's statement Wednesday that he was wanting to basically say he respectfully disagreed with the court's decision and that his committee's investigation that's ongoing into the federal government's alleged censorship should continue, and that he has a bill, the Censorship Accountability Act, which is intended to protect Americans from quote-unquote unconstitutional censorship industrial complex. Basically, it would try to address government outreach to platforms and private entities, something you say that there could be a need for. So I wonder what role you think Congress could play, or if you think it's up to Congress to do some rules of the road on how much outreach the government should have or shouldn't have to private entities.
I absolutely think there's a role for Congress. I'm not at all persuaded that Representative Jordan should be the one playing that role. You know, it is legitimate for Congress to investigate whether the government has stepped over the constitutional line in trying to pressure the platforms to take down speech. From what I can tell, most of what his committee has focused on, though, is not the activity of the government, but the activity of private researchers who have their own First Amendment rights to engage in whatever research they like. They have their own First Amendment rights to talk to the platforms. They have their own First Amendment rights to consult with the government. They have their own First Amendment rights even to pressure the platforms to take down constitutionally protected speech. That is part of the give and take of private speech that the First Amendment protects. Even when private actors are calling for the suppression of speech you like, really, I think what is going on when it comes to that committee and some of the other efforts to go after nominally the executive branch, but largely private researchers, is a fundamental disagreement about what the First Amendment should protect against. The line that the Supreme Court has drawn since 1963, so for the last 60 years, is the line between persuasion and coercion. And the Supreme Court has made clear that to be able to effectively govern, our government needs to be able to try to persuade the public to agree with it. It needs to be able to try to galvanize public opinion and focus it on the most important issues of the day. At the same time, the government should not be allowed to engage in coercion. It should not be allowed to try to induce the platforms and other hosts of speech into taking down that speech. And this lawsuit reflected, I think, a different take on that constitutional line. And actually, the plaintiffs in the case very explicitly made a much broader claim. They said the government had no role even to engage in persuasion when its goal was the suppression of constitutionally protected speech. In other words, it wanted the government out of the business entirely of commenting on the question of whether speech should stay up or be taken down. That would be a very drastically different constitutional rule than the one the Supreme Court set out 60 years ago. And it would be one that would make it very difficult for the government to comment on, again, the most important questions of the day. And so I think that disagreement in First Amendment principle is really what underlies Jim Jordan's committee and many of the other efforts to go after, again, nominally the government, but, you know, more directly the private researchers who are engaged, you know, in their own constitutionally protected speech and research.
We also want to learn what impact this could have for future executive branch outreach to platforms. Obviously, this case was going after the Biden administration and their perceived views of misinformation related to COVID-19 and election outcomes coming from largely conservatives on the platforms that they disagreed with. But if we have Donald Trump in office again, could you foresee a different administration also trying to persuade platforms? And what could this ruling mean for Trump 2.0 administration?
I think it's a really good question and really is hard to predict. You know, every administration has been attracted to the possibility of, you know, if not censorship, trying to persuade people to agree with them. You know, President Trump in his, you know, during his term in office engaged in a lot of that kind of pressure. And I think it may be that you'll get different opinions from people about whether the pressure crossed the constitutional line, but there are a lot of examples. He pressured the NFL to change its rules on peaceful political protest when Colin Kaepernick took a knee during the singing of the national anthem. That was a form of pressure. I don't think that was, you know, personally coercive. I think that was a form of an attempt at persuasion, but, you know, you could argue that that was coercive. And he certainly did the same thing when it came to some media organizations who he characterized as enemies of the state, peddling in, you know, in disinformation. So I think we're likely to continue to see the government trying to pressure all sorts of speech intermediaries into suppressing speech they don't like. And, you know, it's for that reason that I wish the Supreme Court had given us greater guidance in this case on where the lines actually are, because the framework of coercion versus persuasion is still the constitutional framework. But the reality is that those two concepts exist along a spectrum. There's no clear line between persuasion and coercion. And so it would have been helpful for the court to give us guideposts for how to distinguish between them, how to know when one shades over into the other, so that there's some predictability in how the rules apply to a future administration, especially given that we're in an election year.
Right. And what we're still waiting on from the court are two other major decisions in the cases of net choice versus two state laws, Florida and Texas, that have to do with forced carriage of speech on social media platforms. So how much do you think today's ruling foreshadows potentially where the court and the justices stand on those cases? We also heard in oral arguments that they seemed a bit skeptical of the state's arguments. So do you foresee those being shot down as well?
I don't think the decision in Murthy gives us much of an indication of how the Supreme Court is going to come out in the net choice cases. But I do think from the oral argument in the case that the most likely result is that the Supreme Court will say that the main provisions of those laws, which require the platforms to leave up certain kinds of speech. In Texas's case, the law forbids the platforms from censoring speech on the basis of viewpoint. And in Florida's case, the law forbids the platforms from taking down the speech of political candidates or journalistic organizations. I think the Supreme Court is most likely to say that those primary provisions of the laws are unconstitutional because they intrude upon the right of the platforms themselves to set up the kinds of expressive communities that they want to set up, and that's a right protected by the First Amendment. But, you know, there's absolutely been some skepticism of that principle expressed by some of the justices. And so that's not at all a foregone conclusion. And it'll be incredibly important to the future of platform regulation what the Supreme Court says in those cases, which is why so many people are anxiously awaiting the decisions.
Right. Well, we certainly are as well. So I wanted to just thank you for joining us on Politico Tech.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. And for more news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Afra Abdullah produced this episode. Annie Reese is managing producer. I'm Rebecca Kern. See you back here tomorrow.